Continuing on, let's get more specifically into Linux FreeSwan and looking at what the project is, who the project is, what's the product, some examples of setting it up. Specifically, I'll look at classical VPN configuration and Road Warrior configuration. And hopefully we'll have some IP by the end of this so that we can do some live demos. And I was hoping to have FreeSwan installed on the wireless router out in the rack in the lobby so that we could and have a pre-shared secret, a published pre-shared secret, so that we could actually get some of you guys to, if you've got laptops, jam in a base DAC card and actually start an encrypted connection to the router. What this would do is it would encrypt the first link so that somebody casually snooping is not going to know where you're going. It's not going to do anything about the rest of the internet, but at least it'll show a practical demonstration of you've got a very insecure medium and you want to secure it so that at least you can get some privacy from the rest of the crowd that's sharing your physical space with antennas. And then we'll... Sorry? Oh, none of them, of course. Yeah, this is a pretty concentrated crowd of of people who could have fun with this technology. And then look at some conclusions and hopefully do a live demo. Okay, the team, as we covered yesterday, and as Henry covered yesterday in his talk, there's basically five of us here in Canada who... are allowed to actually be technical. Starting with Henry. Actually, can we get people to stand up? Henry? Henry Spencer's our technical lead. He does all the basic technical project management, managing the CVS tree, doing scripts, like he said yesterday, the bits that other people don't want to do. cutting releases, that kind of thing. Hugh Redlmeyer is our keying daemon programmer. They're both based in Toronto. Sandy Harris is our documentation person. And Claudia Schmein, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Schmein. Is our listress. The rest of the team is non-technical because they're in the States. Hugh Daniel, who is sitting here, beats on our software and tries to break it and does an admirable job, I must say. And John Gilmore is the executive of the project. Our code's free in a number of different ways, which we'll see in another slide. And we've got lots of non-US people that are contributing to the code. The people who are in the US... we've unfortunately had to tell them to shut up about technical stuff, but we've encouraged them to whinge as much as they can about all of the stuff that doesn't work so that we can try and fix it. We've had some very good feedback from John Denker, who's running a fairly large, our deployed standards network that he's having fun with that one.
Is this still a limitation?
Sorry?
It's only a limitation if you believe, like the U.S. government believes, that you subhuman foreigners are too stupid to do crypto. That's what they tell me.
Okay.
That the world will be safe for U.S. democracy if you people just never have the tools of freedom.
An idea was that. And do you pay your taxes in the USA?
I'm afraid I have to fund these criminals. I try to do it as little as possible.
You can join us by becoming join the mailing list and become a user, tester, and or programmer if you're not in the States.
We can't accept any code from USS of A citizen slave units, despite this week's supposed liberalizations and the January changes. They've actually never changed any of those regulations, and the ones they did change were pure bullshit. So we are keeping our project free of imperial involvement, shall we say.
Is the mailing list on your webpage?
Yes, there's links and instructions on how to subscribe from www.freeswan.org.
Yeah, because I
Yeah, it is. I've been doing other things, running around giving talks to people. But we're adding more people to address these issues and to flesh out the pages. Actually, the pages did get fleshed out a little more a few weeks ago.
It's protected by the GPL, so it's freely distributable, and this actually helps us in a lot of ways, especially in Canada, where there's a special clause that says public domain software is not covered by this stuff or not restricted. We don't do key escrow, which is one of the ways that U.S. companies have been able to export their products. Key recovery is another way that they've managed to get some concessions. The one place where we're explicitly non-IPsec compliant is that we do not implement DES anymore. It specifies that DES is a must, and it specifies that 3DES is a should. We do 3DES, and we do not do DES. And the reasons for that are partly some of the work that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has done to build a machine to show that the U.S. government is lying in terms of, oh, DES is safe enough. And I've actually cracked some of these keys to show that fact.
We're also working on getting the standard changed, but it turns out in this case the corporations are our enemy, because the corporations are all more interested in profit than in securing the Internet. And so they want to be able to export what is convenient and what their lords in Washington will allow them to. So we've not been able to completely... I'm sorry, but I would like to be... be proud of my government. All right? All of these rules on crypto are declarations, the way King George and Stalin ruled. There's no law. There's no congressional oversight in this. Matter of fact, the declarations attempt to declare that there can be no even judicial oversight. So it's really sick and twisted. In any case, we're trying to get the IETF to change these standards. It's unfortunately a slow and political process, which is also showing up that we've got bigger problems than the IETF because we've got politics outweighing technology.
And that was part of the Ike versus Futuris problem as well.
Excuse me?
Sorry?
See Henry's shirt yesterday, the new ISO networking model, two layers at the top, the financial and the political.
Yeah, I would argue that there's a layer missing from that, and that there's also the religious layer that goes in there.
Is that on top or bottom, though?
I haven't entirely figured out where it goes, but it does go in there. I'm really tempted to grab a black marker and draw it in.
Oh, what I was going to add is a little carrot. And it says, a little note over here, it says, you are stuck at this layer.
Obviously, it can be downloaded free from our site. It's included now with SUSE 6.3+. And I'm trying to think what other distributions.
The other distribution, just to plug the local homeboys.
Oh, yes. This Rebel.
Rebel's Office Server 2.0, which was announced this week, I believe. I worked on the press release, at least my quote from it, but I haven't actually seen it in the wild, as it were. Are the machines out?
I believe so. Yes, they're.
Okay, so it's out and shipping. Anyway, Rebel Office 2.0 has a couple of VPN solutions, including our FreeSwan product. Yay to Rebel for doing this, by the way. This is great.
You're welcome.
The other benefit is that...
Signal! Hallelujah. Praise the IP.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah.
But they just wired in another hub in the back of the room, of course. Excuse me? I'm about to go do DHCP.
I've got a light. Yeah, that looks good.
And I'm on the net. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to go read email. See you all later.
Almost on the net. All right, where's the net?
Thick yellow ones. All right, one of us has to talk. Only one of us can log in at a time.
I'll let you do that then.
What, the login or the talk?
The login. I'll continue. Okay. The other benefit is that this stuff can run on otherwise obsolete hardware. My gateway is a 486 DX66, and it's running probably 45 or 50 tunnels. I found that putting in about 1,400 accounting rules into my accounting chain with IPFW ADM under 2.0 slows down the machine far more than 3DES does. Okay, selected features. We've now got RSA pre-shared public keys, which makes Practical Road Warrior much easier. Before, we used to use one pre-shared key for all Road Warriors, which was kind of a problem for controlling the keying space. And we limited it to one key at that point because it just became impractical to go and search through to try and decrypt the message with every single pre-shared secret out there to figure out which one that came from. And that could be potentially a serious denial of service attack. So now that we've got the RSA pre-shared public keys, that makes things a lot easier. There's an Ike keying daemon, and there's also manual keying, which is included. We've now gone to PFKey v2 keying. The keying interface to enable interoperability with other platforms and protocols keying daemons. The idea is that Futurus will use a PFKey as well, so that we can just drop that in. And PFKey is designed such that you can drop in more than one keying daemon, and they should all be able to cooperate. They send messages down into the kernel, and then it's broadcast back up, missing the keys, so that the other keying daemons have an idea of what's going on without compromising any of the keying material. OpenBSD is, I would say, the closest implementation to our PFKey v2. There are a couple of places where they're specifically deviant from the specification. I'm not quite sure why they are. But in terms of the extensions, we've added extensions for doing routing, policy at least. And their policy extensions are the closest to ours. Kame also has policy extensions in it because they wanted to see policy stuff in it, and theirs are a little bit more distant. We'd really like to see all three of them come together so that we can just take keying daemons from any platform and drop them around. The feedback that I've heard is that Raccoon, which is the Ike daemon for Kame, is still a long way away, and so that would be one reason we might actually want to take Pluto and drop it into Kame, or they may want to take Pluto and drop it into Kame, except they might have a problem with our license. But anyway, for those who don't know, Kame is a BSD implementation of IPsec and IPv6, which drops into NetBSD, OpenBSD, or FreeBSD. OpenBSD is not such an issue because that's produced in Canada and it has IPsec built into it. It has Isaac AMPD and Futurus D, which ship with it. We've now got firewall modification scripting hooks so that when Pluto brings up a connection or it actually sends the keying material down for keying a connection, it's also able to call a script and say, go modify my firewall rules so that these particular types of packets will be allowed through now. There's now PERTA-SA statistics, so you can go and pull up and find out what connections and how many packets have flowed on a per-connection basis. Using automatic keying, your security associations are going to be recycled every 8 hours. On default, you can change that in the configuration files. So unless you're looking at them frequently or you know how long the connection has been up, which is included in the statistics, then you know an ongoing system where it perhaps automatically records the statistics every time it changes a connection might be a useful thing. That's not in there yet. But the statistics are kept per SA, and you can access that. There's now inbound policy checking, which is in. It's not completely perfect yet because of the way that we've implemented our security policy database, which isn't really a security policy database yet, and that's a subject of that's one of the prime subjects of our open design meeting, which I guess is this afternoon.
We need more work.
So anybody who has an interest in that stuff, please come and join us. That'll be at 4:30 upstairs on the second floor in the boardroom. The executive lounge, I guess, same thing. There's some IPv6 work that has been started. Gerhard Gessler is here, and he's started doing some work. Some of those changes have been integrated in with the PF key stuff. He's done no changes to the kernel yet, but I've been keeping the kernel IPv6 in mind as I've been doing recent kernel coding. There are changes that he's made to Pluto, which haven't made it yet into Pluto, but they're but we're going to try and integrate them sooner rather than later. DNSSEC key record generation and lookup. There's preliminary support in Pluto now. And I understand that some of the tests actually work.
Tests? My team doing tests?
DNSSEC.
Nothing to do with DNSSEC, just DNS for fetching the keys. There's it's not really part of our job.
Okay.
To do the security part.
Right, okay, but you've got the fetching stuff in Pluto to be able to go and get the keys from DNS.
But only when manually asked to go get the keys.
Okay, so that's in the configuration file. So there's preliminary support. Okay.
It's one of the new records added for DNSSEC.
Where was I? Dynamic physical device removal. Okay. We had a bug simply because we hadn't tried it in that until I actually got my laptop and started using the stuff and yanking PCMCIA cards out and watching the thing crash because it was still trying to send stuff on a non-existent Ethernet. Well, that's been fixed now, and when you yank it out, it disappears, and it disappears gracefully. It has been tested on SMP. Whether or not it actually does threading, which I kind of doubt, is another question, but I was rather surprised and very pleased when we first tested it on SMP. It compiled, it installed, it ran, it didn't crash, and it actually worked. Recent stuff is somewhat more questionable, but yeah, I tested on, Marc Boucher and I tested it on 2399 pre-3 in Canberra, and it worked.
Okay, there was some guy around the FreeSwan 1.2 days who recently pissed on us. It was the only person to piss on us in a slash dot thing. And it was some guy who was trying to run it on a bleeding-edge SMP system. He was really upset that it didn't work on that system, and therefore we were useless to anyone. And I'm like, well, I don't normally read all the posts in the slashdot item, but this was a slashdot item that basically said, is there any VPN for Linux? And I was kind of like, well, did anyone mention us?
Yeah, many people did.
Yes. But one person pissed on us. It was the SMP stuff, which since I don't run a machine like that, I don't know if it's trustable. I mean, testing it for a few hours in Canberra is very different than one of us having an SMP machine as our security gateway that we trust.
And in fact, one of us does, and we're relying on him for some feedback.
Well, yeah, but does he run it, Sandy? So you've been running an SMP machine since 1.3 days, so for 4 months.
Well, I forget exactly. I put the spin locks in 1.1 or 1.2 because on a UP machine, Hugh ran into a race. And so I said, okay, time to do this right. And I just went and did the SMP thing, SMP safe thing. And
I never had any problems. I connect fine. It's up right now.
Good.
If I wanted to, I could just run my laptop along, set up a tunnel with home right now if I wanted to.
Good. ISDN PPP has been a bit of a nuisance, but and partly because the PPP headers or the ISDN headers are not necessarily a predetermined size, and so we had to do some fiddling and try and figure out exactly where the packet starts and stops, whatever which layers of headers. Marc Boucher did a lot of useful work there. There's now extensive online man pages and HTML documentation, which is a big improvement over before. Thank you, Sandy. Features 3DES encryption. We use HMAC MD5 and HMAC SHA-1 authentication. That's all we support at the moment. We've had some contributions of other code, some of it we could not accept because of licensing issues, some we could not accept because of patent issues.
Some we could not accept
because of the vertical slice issue.
Because, yeah, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get a vertical slice of the whole application, which is something we haven't yet talked about, but we will, most importantly at the top, called opportunistic encryption, where instead of us all having to set this up manually and it breaks as soon as networking changes, it all just kind of works magically. And to tell you the truth, a lot of contributions of, oh, there's this experimental crypto algorithm, and here I've branded into FreeSwan. That's worrying about breadth, and I'm working on getting this vertical slice of the entire problem solved. And afterwards, we can play with random crypto algorithms or something like this. But that's weird breadth. We've also been not paying as much attention to the community maybe as we should, but we haven't been doing things that we don't think are secure or are not really good for the system in the long run, specifically garbage like X509 systems, which are incredibly hierarchical, incredibly complex, and certain corporations really want. We want to make these people happy in the long run somehow, but we really want secure DNS to be the keying mechanism of the future, because we're really fairly certain that's going to scale reasonably, where X509 systems will probably scale even to the largest corporations, but we doubt they'll scale to the population of humans on the planet, which is once again where we're aiming our designs.
The code is statically linkable or a modular kernel module, so if you're particularly paranoid, you can compile it straight into the kernel. It's much more difficult to recompile an entire new kernel and reboot the machine without getting noticed than it is to pop out a kernel module. However, it has been pointed out that for somebody to pop out a kernel module, your root has still been compromised, and there isn't any hope. But at least at least you'll notice sooner if somebody goes and reboots your machine on you to get the kernel out of there. The debug level is controllable both in kernel for the kernel code and the user space code, so that that helps us to track down problems. In terms of kernels, currently in use by our team, we've got stuff from 2036 to 2038 in active use. The stuff back to 2030 should probably work, but it hasn't been tested in a while, and I'm sure there's people out there still using 2030 or something as equally old. 225 was the first one that we'd actually tried it on, and that's the one that we had supported, which was the one distributed by default in, what was it, Red Hat 6? And up to 2216, and 2217 should work, but I haven't been actively testing it. I have 240 test 1 working. 240 test 2 does not work yet. I simply haven't had the time to fix what looks like to be some fairly trivial changes in the kernel between those two versions. Marc Boucher has some changes, which he hasn't posted the mailing list yet, so whenever he does that, they'll get in fairly soon. In terms of distributions, we develop on Red Hat, and we've done some active work with SUSE to get it into their distribution, and with the Netwinder. I should have mentioned the Rebel distribution in the distribution list. We have reports from Slackware and Debian that it also works, so it should work on Corel as well. In terms of CPUs, our primary development platform is Intel, but Netwinder, PowerPC, two different PowerPCs. There's been some good work done by Peter Onion in the UK on the Alpha 64. SunSpark, there's reports, and MIPS, there's also reports of it working. The Alpha 64 stuff shook out a lot of portability issues, and that made it a lot easier to go to other platforms.
What?
ColdFire?
Oh, I thought it was a CPU for a second there.
It is. It's an embedded.
It's a good 68 power.
Mm. Okay.
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah.
In terms of interoperability, we go to interoperability workshops a couple times a year, several times a year.
About once every 8 or 9 months is okay. How often they're held.
Okay. And we just set up a bunch of equipment and say, okay, time to talk to you guys. And so we go and set up tunnels and work out some of the bugs in configuration systems, and then post all of the useful information for people to be able to get the stuff to interoperate. And this is a list of stuff that we've had reports that it interoperates with. This would be most, and the IPsec layers are fairly standard, and that's not much of a challenge to get that stuff working. The big challenge is to get Ike working between the machines.
And now, after years of effort, he can just blithely say that it wasn't a challenge.
It's a relative thing. It wasn't as much of a challenge as Ike continues to be. Which points out the vagueness or complexity in the Ike standards, and strong suggestion that maybe they should be simplified because they're just too complicated. Anyway, let's go to some examples. In terms of setup, we go get the distribution, unpack the thing, read the documentation. Seriously, read the documentation. Not just because our stuff is has its own quirks, but there's a lot of background on IPsec just to understand why you would want this, what its capabilities are, what it's designed to do, what it's not designed to do, and just to get some background. Grab a kernel. Configure your kernel for your site and test it. Looking at step number 9, if the previous step has not been performed and passed, your warranty is void. We'll give you a refund on what you paid for it. Compile and install FreeSwan utilities and patches. Configure the kernel, saving the configuration. Install the kernel. Then do your setup configuration, which means to set up your test connections and figure out whether you're doing automatic or manual keying. Figure out your subnets, all of that kind of thing. Basically design your network and then code that into the configuration file. And then reboot with your new FreeSwan kernel and test it. Hugh goes into more detail about how to set up a test jig so that you can be very certain about what you're doing before you deploy this live and risk some live data. His classical setup is a ping host on one end, security gateway, then some kind of router, and then another security gateway and a ping host. The router in between serves two purposes. One is to test your next hop parameters, which are coded into the configuration files. The other one is to provide a completely independent platform where you can start sniffing packets to make sure that things are going right. If you're sniffing packets from the machine on which one of the gateways is, then you could be making a mistake of which interface that you're snooping. Or using the 2.0 kernels, there's some known problems with TCP dump sniffing packets from IPsec. And you'll end up with some very strange-looking stuff that you start wondering if anything is actually working, when in fact it is, and it's bugs in libpcap that are causing the problems. So having a fifth independent machine in the middle where you can start sniffing packets makes it a lot easier to do the tests properly. Right. So, the basic configuration file, the interfaces line, if you've got a fairly simple setup where you've got two interfaces, or just one in the case of a road warrior or a host only, then you're probably going to have a default route which goes to the internet at large, and that's likely where your IPsec connection is going to go. If this is not the case, then you need to replace the percent default route with the actual hardware interface where the stuff is going. I do lots of tests on my network. My firewall's got 4 Ethernets and a PPP on it. So I've got 3 of those Ethernets that actually have IPsec tunnels coming out of them. The 4th one is a test subnet with nothing behind it that knows anything about IPsec, so I don't need to put an interface there. So I need to customize this line so that I've got, here's an example at the bottom. For example, IPsec 0 equals ETH 0 and IPsec 1 equals PPP 0. If your PPP 0 doesn't exist at the time when you bring this stuff up, it'll ignore that line and it'll keep going, bringing up only one IPsec interface.
So if you bring your PPP 0 up afterwards, you have to respec 3.1?
That's the easiest way to do it.
A more graceful way to handle that is coming.
Yeah, it's not quite there yet, but it's coming. If this isn't configured properly, nothing will work. So this is a fairly important line. Like I said, the default should be okay for most people. Eclipse debug and Pluto debug are flags for turning on your debugging levels. If you're having problems, you might want to turn them on. If you're curious, you might want to turn part of it on. If you turn everything on, your logs are going to fill very quickly. And your machine's going to slow down because of all the logging. And at that point, then you might want to turn your syslog, turn off the synchronization flag for any of your logging files that are logging this stuff. The last two lines are kind of important. Pluto load and Pluto start, if you set percent search as the value, then anything that's listed in Pluto load, it'll go out and look for all of the connections that it's expected to load at boot time so that it will be prepared to receive connections on those particular connection specs. For Pluto start, if you put in percent search, then it will load those connections and try and initiate a connection with the other end. The ones that you would put in Pluto load would be your road warriors, and machines that are not necessarily up all the time. Those would be the ones, especially the road warriors, because you have no idea where the address is that you're expecting to come in on, so you can't put in them in Pluto start. But all of your VPN gateways to head office and things like that should always be there, that's the kind of thing you want to put in Pluto start. Now, you could specifically list the connection names on that line, but it's easier to put in percent search. And then within each connection spec, there's a parameter that says do this or do this by default or just ignore it by default. There will be a secrets file, which is generated on install. And I'm not sure of the exact format, but this is a recommended format to use. You'll end up with @gateway@site1.example.org. Now, I believe it puts in the machine name now.
The current software, in fact, normally builds an RSA key pair as part of the install. You don't have to worry about this.
Right. But what it does is it puts in the machine name. It puts in @machine_name:, and all of the rest of the stuff, installs the secret key, and it also produces a separate file with the public key. Okay. So, anyway, it generates, obviously, the public key at the same time, and then it's a matter of taking that public key and distributing that to the hosts to which you expect to connect.
It's now past noon. It's 17.
We don't believe that anybody takes our format except us.
It's a problem. Support for at least one or two of the more popular formats on my list, but that's likely to be a headache when you're talking about other systems, because each one of them has its own different,
If someone were looking for an itch to scratch, is it technically possible to take a key formatted in your style and run it through a conversion program?
Actually, I think it's much worse than that. They all want you certificate.
Oh, that's better. Yes. Okay. The real user contributed code to the conversion. I'm not sure in what direction between us and PGP now. Current versions of PGP shipped with a IPsec plan implementation in the package.
Then one of the things that you also need to do is to take that public key and to drop it into your connection spec for where you're going to connect to the connections that you're expecting to connect to other people. And there's a left RSA SIG key and right RSA SIG key parameters that are in the configuration file. Now, to set up a classical VPN, can we fit everything on the screen? Almost. Okay, right at the top, we've got con, site 1, site 2. Con is a section notifier that says this is a section, this is a connection section, and then you give it a name. This is what you would use on the command line to say, I want to bring up or down or delete this connection or whatever. Okay. Then left, we chose a left versus right paradigm for setting connection specifications so that we could take a configuration file and copy it straight to the other machine without having to flip the local versus remote tags. This has had its benefits, and it seems to still be the mostly the right way of doing things, but it's not perfect. In particular, Road Warriors, you need to change. I'll get to that when we get to the Road Warrior configuration. So left, you would have an IP address. Then left next hop would be its gateway that is closer towards the internet. So looking here, you've got your left gateway machine. There's your subnet that's behind it. So you've got a subnet here. That address would be part of that subnet. Then your left gateway, it's the outside address that you want to list as left. Then you've got a router here with its interface. That's going to be the next hop. So if you look in your routing table under default, then you should have a gateway address. It's that gateway address that we're interested in.
Can you talk about why we had to do this?
We have to do that because the original software uses virtual interfaces to trap all the packets that are going out of the machine. This is suboptimal, and we're working on changing that. And that's one of the things that is the topic of the Open Design meeting this afternoon. We're trying to get away from that because it has limited a number of other people from doing some useful stuff, in particular routing daemons have difficulties with this type of virtual interface. It also makes it more difficult to be able to do inbound policy checking on every single packet. So that's part of the design, redesign issues. Right. So the percent default route parameter will automatically go out and look in your routing table to try and figure out what that is so that you don't have to worry about your next hop parameters. Then this stuff in between here, we don't care about.